This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington, and there's an old rule of thumb for radio hosts. Never invite a guest who's got a better voice than you do. Thomas Quastoff clearly violates this principle. Fortunately, Thomas Quastoff not only has a great voice, he has, by his own admission, a big mouth. The celebrated baritone joins us today from Berlin to talk about his music and his autobiography, which describes the unlikely success of a thalidomide baby born with deformed limbs who now stands at just about 4 feet tall, his struggle to become a professional musician, and about his life now as a teacher, a singer, and an international celebrity. Later in the program, we ask, what's recession-proof in your life? The one indulgence you won't give up in tough times. You can send us an email now. The address is talk@npr.org. But first, if you'd like to talk with Thomas Quastoff about his career, his music, and how he managed to achieve it, our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email address again is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Thomas Quastoff joins us from Berlin. His book is called appropriately, The Voice, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
And do you consider yourself a lucky man?
Who can say that a life of a person permanently is lucky? I have a wonderful wife. I have a wonderful little girl who's living with us. We have a wonderful apartment. I have a lot to do. I'm booked till 2:11, 2:12. I'm flying tomorrow to the Salzburg Festival to have a recital with Anders Schiff. I'm healthy momentarily, and I would definitely call myself momentarily a lucky man.
Momentarily. The drug that your mother was given when you were just in her womb, in a way, you were lucky then. Thalidomide can cause all kinds of problems, and yours were just in your limbs.
Well, it was not a kind of pain relief medicament. It was a sleeping pill. As a sleeping pill, it was extremely successful. It was so successful that it was not only sold in Germany, it was sold worldwide. And the thing was that maybe the testing in the laboratories were not intense enough. And the big problem was that the company knew in 1962 that this medicament is improving these kind of handicap, but they took it from the market nearly a year later. This is what makes a lot of the disabled people who have the problem with thalidomide angry and sad. And But on the other side, what can you do? There's no medicament which will change this. And I learned not only from my parents, also from life, that the only chance that you have to get over this is to make the best out of it. And thank God I had the talent, and I had parents who were supporting me in a wonderful and beautiful way, and so I could really develop my talent that I have, and
In a way, the way you describe it in your book, the breakthrough was the day that your father brought home a tape recorder.
That's true. Yeah, it was one of these technical miracles, even in Germany, that we didn't know before. And we worked a lot of this. We made a lot of house music together with my brother, who's playing a lot of instruments and is also writing lyrics. And so there was permanently music in our house, not always for the joy of my parents, but because the interest were not only in classical music. We both my brother and me, we turned very early to jazz, and not only the old-time jazz, it was really like John Coltrane, Ornette Coleman, and so more free and modern jazz. And for a generation, my parents were both born in 27 and 26. That was not really the music that they liked extremely. But
your father at one point just shaking his head. It's just noise. It's just noise.
Well, I think that every young generation. It is very interesting that especially parents always expecting respect from the younger ones. The problem of the younger ones is that they don't know how it is to be old, but the old know how it is to be young. So it would be maybe a little bit easier for the older people to accept that especially young people have this kind of interests. But it was not a war. It was really this kind of normal little family struggles, which every normal family has.
And your family stuck to you and defended you every step along the way against an establishment, a musical academy, for example, that would not let you enter.
Well, you have to see all these things in a context. I mean, that sounds first, if you hear that now, very rude. The law at that time was not made for people with a disability that I have. I mean, you have in America one of the biggest examples of, greatest examples of musicians with disability. I think to Itzhak Perlman, for example. But he is a violinist. His arms are normal, and nobody really expected or could imagine that a person with my kind of disability would be ever able to stay on stage and having a kind of career, not talking about the way of life that I took till now.
We're talking with Thomas Kwasthoff, the celebrated baritone. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And I wanted to draw a distinction, and you write about this in the book. You sing a lieder, as we call them in this country, and you make a comparison with opera singers that I thought was quite interesting. Opera singers, you say, well, as long as you have a beautiful voice, you can have a career. If you sing lieder, you need to be more. You have to have a lot more than just a pretty voice.
Well, first of all, I have to correct you a little bit, because I did, for example, for my company Deutsche Grammophon, a complete recording with opera arias. I sang Fidelio at the Eastern Opera Festival in Salzburg. I did the Amfortas in Parsifal in the Vienna State Opera. So I have this opera experience too. Well, the thing is, as a lead singer, you have only the piano and the soloist, so talk, the singer on stage. So that's the smallest form of communicating with an audience. That means every eyebrow is being watched, every little mistake cannot be hided behind costumes, behind an opera direction, behind a staging. It is much more pure than any kind of music making that you even have. Also comparing to instrumentalists, because they have their instruments. My instrument is not visible. So the contact is so direct and so intimate that I think that lead singing is really the most maybe difficult form of music making, but also the most wonderful form, because there's no musical subject which is comparable To this intimate situation that you have as a lead singer.
Of course, you're right about your performances in opera, yet you avoided opera for a very long time.
The thing was, I didn't want to have this kind of sensation that a disabled person is singing opera. I wanted first to establish myself as a concert singer, including Mahler songs with orchestras and oratoriums and cantatas and all these kind of variable repertoire that you can have before going on stage as an opera singer. And I think the fact that I was waiting so long was totally right. Beside of all, I loved to sing concerts and lead, so I didn't miss really the opera world. And it was finally Simon Rattle who convinced me to try it, and I'm trusting him really very much still. I mean, he's one of my really close friends, and for all the people who didn't know him, he's the chief conductor and the director of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. I'm very sorry, but I think it's the best orchestra momentarily in the world. And without him, I don't think that I would have taken this kind of decision.
We'll get calls from the New York Philharmonic in just a moment. More with Thomas Kvasthoff. His memoir, again, is titled The Voice. If you'd like to join our conversation, our phone number is 800-989-8255, or you can send us email. The address is talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Our guest today is Thomas Kvasthoff, the celebrated baritone. In addition to the many arias and lieder that he's sung, he's also tried his hand at jazz.
They all laughed at Christopher Columbus when he said the world was round. They all laughed when Edison recorded sound. They all laughed at Wilbur and his brother when they said that man could fly. They told Marconi Wireless was a phony. It's the same old cry. They laughed at me watching you. Said I was reaching for the moon. But oh, you came through. Now they have to change their tune. They all said we never could be happy. They laughed at us and how. But ho, 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 who's got the last laugh now?
Thomas Kvasthoff singing They All Laughed by George Gershwin from an album of standards called Watch What Happens. Thomas Kvasthoff is our guest today. In his memoir, The Voice, he writes that performing is a lot like rock climbing. You can read more about that in an excerpt and hear him perform on our website at npr.org/talk. If you'd like to talk with Thomas Kvasthoff about his career, his music, and how he managed to achieve it, our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's go to the phones. This is Tom, and Tom's calling us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Great. I remember seeing a performance of the Boston Symphony Orchestra doing Benjamin Britten's War Requiem with Thomas Kvasthoff as a soloist, and I didn't realize that Mr. Kvasthoff had a disability, and it was just very emotional watching him make his way out onto the stage singing this wonderful work about reconciliation after World War II, and obviously his disability has nothing to do with the war, but it was extremely powerful and added to the entire tenor of the evening, so to speak. I'm wondering if he finds himself being drawn to works depicting suffering and maybe even just using his disability to make a more emotional impact.
Shall I answer directly?
Yes, please.
Okay. First of all, I'm a much too much positive person that I would always and only choose pieces which are sad and about suffering or anything. You know, I cannot really tell if my way of singing would be different if I had not this disability, because I never lived without that. So, well, if you sing Schubert songs, for example, there are so many also positive songs, or Hugo Wolf, for example, wrote so many funny things. Mm-hmm. First of all, the War Requiem, of course, is a kind of thinking in a very philosophic way about the necessity of war and fighting. I definitely would say that maybe my impact, because of my disability, or the fact that my life started much earlier seriously than maybe for other boys in my age, maybe gives me another impact into music generally. But I would not say that I'm the singer for tragic music. Definitely not. I hope not.
That was one of the most emotional performances I've ever heard.
I remember that concert also. Yeah, it was a very, very moving concert, and I really think back with pure joy, because with Seiji Ozawa, it was really very special to work. And I, by the way, I love Boston. I love this orchestra. I love the hall, and I hope to come back very soon.
Tom,
thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. In
fact,
that Mahler piece we began the program with, that's a pretty funny piece, too. You're kicking critics down the hallway.
Of course. I mean, this is what I say. I mean, if you handle music, there is not always tragical music. I mean, beside of all that, of course, Schubert's life was not really what you would call easy and sweet and nice.
No, not a laugh riot, no.
Yes, but whenever was a life of a composer easy? Even in our days, I think it's even more difficult than it may be in the past.
Let's talk with Eve. Eve is on the phone from Davis in California.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. I I just wanted to commend and applaud Mr. Kostoff for his work. And I'm a jazz vocalist and a voice coach here in Davis, and have had some disabilities since I was a child. And I would love to have you comment on maybe the differences between working with small audiences. You talked about the very intimate setting of singing leader, and I do a lot of very intimate audience-type shows, and just the difference between that and doing, you know, very large audiences with, you know, symphonic and a much grander scale, the difference for you personally in how you feel you're relating to the audience?
I don't think that, especially for me, that there is a big difference, because I am, I think, a singer who needs a very intense contact to an audience, and it doesn't matter if the audience is small or big. If you are not able as a singer to create this kind of intimacy, no, that's the wrong English word, right?
Intimacy, no, that's it.
Intimacy, even in a big hall or in a hall with, well, let's say 300-400 people, then something is wrong. I think it's really very important that you are able, with your expression and your personality, to create this direct contact to an audience. I think that the times changed of performing changed a lot, because in the past we had this types of singer who was standing on stage like a statue, singing their stuff, taking a bow and went off stage. For me, for an example, it's very important. I talk to an audience even in very serious classical places like Salzburg or Vienna Musikverein or other big halls or Carnegie Hall, because I realized in every concert where I did this that from that moment on when I talked to an audience, the the connection between me and the audience was much more intense in a second. I don't think that there is a huge, really huge difference for me. I mean, of course, acoustically, it's a big difference if you sing in a huge hall like Carnegie Hall or in a little chamber hall like Wigmore Hall in London, where 400 people fits. But that's all. I mean, you have to handle every acoustic. I mean, you are a class singer or you are not. And I think a class singer of a special class has to handle this very professionally.
Eve, thanks.
Is this answering your question?
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that the intimacy level is there for you, because I think that's true. When you're in a large performance, the audience needs to feel that you're singing to them.
Exactly.
Each person really feels that connection.
There's a little secret that my teacher, it's not a secret, told me, which was really very easy. And it was that if you watch one people in the middle of the hall and looking into the face of this person, everybody feels touched. Really, and it works.
Eve, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
In fact, you write in the book that your experience singing jazz in smoky clubs and playing in pubs and other places, doing material that's not necessarily the great classical repertoire, that made it possible for you to realize that you're an entertainer and made it possible for you to be a different kind of singer.
I think that this goes in the direction that I said before. I think the time changed a lot. We have a media world, and I don't think that we have still the time where everything has to be like 30, 40 or 50 years ago. Let me speak with Simon Rattle again, who said once to me, there are people who have not only one talent, they have variable talents. And the only positive way of living as an artist and even from the view of the audience is, if it's good, let him, let him do it. And as long as I have the feeling that I have something to say with classical music or jazz or so-called popular music, that doesn't mean music without any niveau. I mean really good music. For example, I even from American artists, I feel very often very sad that they are coming here to Europe with this Schubert, Schumann, Brahms repertoire. And you have composers like Irving Berlin. You have composers like George Gershwin, which composed first class, wonderful, beautiful songs. And I try to open the minds of the people a little bit that every kind of music can have their qualities. And I would be very bored if I would not have the chance to perform this what I like.
Let's talk with Aaron. Aaron with us from Syracuse in New York.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Hi.
You have such a marvelous resonant voice and such clear speaking diction as well as singing diction. I wanted to ask you about various venues. One could see you doing anything from, singing leader as you do and soloing as you do to being a voiceover for a movie character or having your own radio show. And what about singing in groups, for example, doing Renaissance type music or Gregorian chant or other such things?
First of all, I disagree saying that every singer can sing everything. You need really a long time to get the experience of this kind of music, and it's a total different way. Especially the Gregorian music and Renaissance music needs this smaller, vibrato-less, voices, and I have a vibrato, which is natural. So, but you know, I'm really looking more and more to other repertoire. I did, for example, last year, a dual recital with Michael Schade together. Michael Schade is really one of the world famous Mozart singers, singing momentarily. I see him tomorrow in Salzburg, I think in Don Giovanni. And we did a duet evening. My next recording, my over next recording, will be Brahms' Love Song Waltzes. So, which is composed for four voices and two pianos. Uh-huh. So, I'm really searching for these kind of different things, but I don't think that every singer can sing everything.
Let me ask
that, by the way, excuse me, if I'm finishing this, that means also if pop singers think that they can sing classical music, that sounds sometimes also very strange. I will not give you names, but I heard some records where I really thought, you know what, pop music is fine and stay with this. And with me, it's the same. I would not sing really literature where I think there are people who are extremely much better than I am.
And you stay away from radio. It's Thomas Kwasthoff, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's go to John. John's with us from Milwaukee.
Hi, Mr. Kwasthoff. It's wonderful to speak with you. I have
Thank
a question
you.
For you. My partner and I are both voice students, classical voice students, are both tenors, and I was just wondering, because I imagine there are a number of young aspiring singers listening, what advice would you give to us in terms of, you know, career planning and just trying to make it in the classical vocal world?
First of all, to plan a career is impossible. You need so many subjects to only for living from that profession. That doesn't mean talking about a career. You need luck, you need a lot of work, you need talent, you need expression, you need artistry, you need a full musicality. So there are so many subjects. You have to be on the right moment at the right place. And that has, of course, also to do with luck. And you have something to say. I mean, this is what I'm recognizing more and more, that the times where only the beauty of a voice was important is changing a little bit. I think it is very important. Let me give you an example. Maybe this is a little bit easier to understand. When I won the RD competition, which is a very big international competition in Munich for singers and for a lot of instrumentalists, everybody was thinking, okay, now you're ready to work with Dietrich Fischer-Dieskau. And I said, I think I have every record from him at home, and I'm a big admirer of his art and his artistry, but I always wanted to find my own way. So I never worked with him. That doesn't mean that I don't like him, but for me it was always important to find my way of finding the approach to classical music and to lead singing. Well, the main important thing that I can only say, if you are a classical singer, try to sing lead. It is medicine for the voice. This is, for example, why I created with some friends a big lead competition next year in Berlin here from the 18th to the 22nd of February in Berlin. And we have a wonderful, wonderful jury with Christa Ludwig, Brigitte Fassbinder, Helmut Deutsch. So great people to support lead singing and everything.
John, thanks very much for the call, and good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
And
bye-bye.
Thomas Kwasthoff, good luck tomorrow in Salzburg.
Thank you.
Thomas Kwasthoff's book is called The Voice, and that's he was speaking to us from a studio in Germany. You can find an excerpt from his book at our website, npr.org/talk. Up next, even in a gloomy economy, some things are just too important to let go. What's the one thing you will not quit on? Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.